2005 House Education Committee will come to order. And welcome, you throngs of folks. We will have a... Do we need a public hearing, or can we have that discussion during a work session?
If you want to go ahead and have a public hearing.
Let's start a public hearing on... Even though it's only listed.
It's only listed on a work session, but you can bring someone up.
Okay. We will open a work session on House Bill 2070. And I think we have some discussion that needs to be come forward in that, and we will do that in the context of our work session. But in the meantime, Mr. Keller, will you please give us an overview?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2070 has been amended. Originally, it specified that a child is a resident of a school district in which the child attends school for the purpose of receipt of state school fund monies by the district. Eliminates the exception for determining residency of a child with disabilities for purposes of attending school. Eliminates the option of school districts allowing a resident child to attend school in another district by contract that transfers school funds to the receiving district. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. The -1 amendment that you have requires that school districts enter into a contract with a child if a child has an individual education plan that states the child would be better served in another district.
Thank you. Representative Butler, did you want to come forward and give us any further information on House Bill 2070 and the -1 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. House Bill 2070 comes to you from my constituents and a group of constituents in southeastern Oregon, and the -1 amendments on the date of April 8, 2005 make some of the desired necessary changes that folks have been expressing concern about relative specifically to trying to focus in on exactly those youngsters who have disabilities and need to be assigned to schools where they will best be able to have those disabilities accommodated, either through the physical structure of the facility or through the teaching structure and teaching staff of the or the actual numbers of days that they're meeting Monday through Friday or Monday through Thursday. So there's a number of elements that have gone into this discussion since the last time you met on this, Madam Chair, and members of the Education Committee. I'd be happy to try and enter into any kind of discussion to encourage this particular piece of legislation to be amended with the -1 amendments as of April 8th and move forward to the full House to do pass recommendation.
Thank you, Rep. Butler. Why don't you just stay there? Susie Harris, Oregon Department of Education, had some comments she wanted to provide us with, and then perhaps we can have a dialogue.
Good afternoon.
Please, for the record, if you'd give us your name and then make your comments.
Okay. I'm Susie Harris, the legal specialist with the Oregon Department of Education. Specifically, I work with the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, formerly known as the Office of Special Education. So my area of work is in special education, and I just saw these amendments for the first time this morning. And I do have some concerns about whether it's necessary to legislate this as it's written. The concerns are that we already have a provision in state law that allows school districts to contract with other school districts for the provision of special education services when it's necessary or appropriate for a student. And this language appears to create a new standard or entitlement that's different than the entitlement under federal law, which is if the needs of the child will be better met in schools of the other district. The standard under state and federal law is appropriateness. So school districts are required to provide a free appropriate public education to a student, and creating a requirement that districts contract for better services when the resident district can provide appropriate services could set things into a path that would have unintended consequences at this point. So I just wanted to make you aware of that concern.
Ms. Harris, thank you for your comments. Now, were your concerns specifically with the -1 amendments or the bill overall?
Well, I only see one provision in the -1 amendments. that basically one, which is requiring a district school board shall contract with the district school board of any other district, that provision. Are we all looking at the same thing?
Yes, my question was, did the House Bill 2070 cause you concern, or is it specifically the Dash 1 amendment?
It's the Dash 1 amendment. I had some concerns about the other bill, too. But
yep, I did not see you on the list as we had heard it had a public
no,
hearing.
No, I didn't
before.
Testify.
Okay.
With
Representative Dahlem?
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. As I understand it right now, and I guess I'll ask Representative Butler, the students that travel out to Harper in this case, are looking for an education that they feel is more appropriate, but there's no state funding that has followed them now.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, that is exactly the case. The students' families have chosen to seek a education which better meets the needs of those specialized education children, and have done so by moving children, in this particular case, a young lady out of a larger, more regimented school system into the smaller system at Huntington, and the family and the student have been very happy about it, and the student has been quite successful, I might add, under this program. So, and there is still no way to convince the folks in the departing school district that this is the best issue for the student, even though the student is excelling.
And if I could do a follow-up on the funding from Ms. Harris, because the bill says that the student where he attends school will become the residence, and Harper has exceeded 11%, there would be no more money than just the basic money, the basic school payment going. Is that correct?
Well, I have to say that the funding part of this is not my area of expertise. My understanding is that if they've exceeded the 11%, there is a process for applying for some additional funds beyond the 11%.
Some additional funds, but it seldom, if ever, covers the excess in special ed attendance. I think it's been my experience with schools I'm familiar with. And if the sending school had exceeded the 11% cap, it really wouldn't affect their spending either, would it? So what we're simply doing is saying to the school district, if the student feels they can get a better education, and better might just be friendlier hands, smiley faces, who knows what better means. But really there's no money changing hands except for the basic education. We're simply saying to the student, you may go where you're most comfortable. Not better, just more comfortable. With that in mind, does it trouble you?
I think it raises lots of questions. What if you have a student on an IEP, a student with disabilities, with very expensive needs, like let's say they need a full-time assistant or a nurse to be able to attend school? Which district is responsible? And how do you work out the contractual relationship between the districts? Here you're saying it's mandatory, but there's really no provision for how you work out what if the costs exceed the first weight or second weight to educate that child. Also, we don't have a total school choice system in the state. And what this does is create a school choice system for a small group of students without justification.
Is it the choice that troubles you or the special ed?
I'm troubled by the ambiguities that it creates for special education students in particular.
Thank you very much.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm a little concerned with the language here also. I think that we've got one case in mind that you're trying to work on and trying to help the family out, and I really appreciate the degree to which you're doing that. On the other hand, the way I read this, it says if somebody's needs are better met in schools of an other district, let's say they're going to Treasure Valley District right now, and they're better met in Weezer or Nampa. under this, they shall contract with that district. I think it's a little written a little broadly, or maybe they should if they send a kid to Portland instead of Harper. I think we need to work on this just a little bit more and tighten up this so it gets to your need, you know, the needs of the constituents, but not have unintended consequences, perhaps.
Madam Chair, Representative Vice Chair March, we certainly understand that as we work on Oregon revised statutes, that they would have absolutely no obligation to be followed in the state of Idaho, Montana, Utah, or Wyoming. My concern here is that within the state of Oregon, and these are Oregon revised statutes on which we're working, that the students, when the child's needs are better met in another school district, that and we are dealing now with admission of a child with a disability in the school other than that school's other than that child's school district, then that they would take that IEP with them. And they would be able to find that school within their district. Now, if with another district, if you feel like that it ought to have, that it would be available for in rural counties in Oregon, then we could certainly do that for counties of under, so that you wouldn't be burdened by these students coming from Mount Hare County to perhaps Multnomah County. You'd like to do it for schools in counties of under 50,000, that would, and we have done that before. There's precedence for that in the law at present that we can serve in a special manner those folks. But I see this as one of families and administrators, by and large, in a large part, concerned about serving the needs of the students and having a vehicle by which it can be done. And where there is some reticence on any school board to lose one student or 20 students as a result of the IEP and the disabilities or other things, I also recognize that in some instances that our children are better served in moving around and finding a little bit different face, and as Representative Gollum says, maybe a friendlier hand. And in this particular instance, I think this is very, very critical in the small communities of those counties of under 50,000.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern, having looked at the Dash 1 amendments, is the definition of better and who makes that decision. Sitting in a school district where you think you're doing a really good job and somebody else says, well, we can do a better job because we offer a full-time assistant with that person the whole time they're coming to our school, and then they say you have to contract with us, and they come to our district and they say we need $50,000 because we're going to provide a better education for our child, for that child when they come to our school, and you're going to pay for it, and you have to have a contract with me. Makes me a little concerned because I could see the contract is required. It doesn't say you can only pay the amount of school support. We have a number of students that we spend a lot more on than the double-weighted basic school support in special education. And so I'm already spending a fair amount, and I go to this other school, and they say they can do a better job because they're going to offer these other kinds of things. And now I have to contract with them and send that money and my staff member. I'm a little concerned about that. So any comments about that concern?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I appreciate that expressed concern, but we are dealing with the basic funding for the student, and if school district A, the exiting school district, is expending $25,000 on that particular student in excess, and they cannot agree with school district B that all of those funds, then we're still back to the basic funding for that particular student. And the student in mind here that Representative Marsh has indicated, very correctly indicated, that the one student does have an IEP program and does have some special needs, but not needs that are expended, that are causing additional expenditures, is my understanding, significant additional expenditures in either district. Has good relationship with the second district, the receiving district, and the child's needs are being better met by, according to the family, according to Everyone, with the exception of perhaps some folks in the Exington School District that would like to keep the funds, and has been perfectly willing to allow that child to be educated in another school district and receive and keep the funds in the first district.
That's not fair either.
And that's true, Representative Roland. It is not fair. I don't think there's any question that the student is being better served. And I guess if you're concerned about being better met, then I guess we have all of the opportunities to assess and judge and analyze a student as they go through. And that's part of the IEP, is to assess and judge and evaluate that student. And if the student has done very, very poorly in the exiting school district and does very, very well in the entry school district, then I guess it wouldn't be a matter of our personal judgment as to what is better met. And that's my concern here, that if we want to define better met as some other criteria, we're welcome to do that. But my concern is that we'll strain the gnat and swallow a camel here.
Representative Dolan.
I'm concerned we have some other situations that are similar to this, in that we have some homes that actively seek students that have special needs, and the idea there is to provide a home, not the schooling as much. When the students come to where I live, the money doesn't follow them. This would give opportunity for that. And what we're saying here, and what the bill says right now, is just the basic school support would go. Now, I'm sure that you could devastate the sending or the losing school special ed dollars if you send it all. But this bill is not doing that. What this bill is saying is mom and dad, who are one of the key factors in determining success in education, have decided, now whether it's right or wrong, they and the child have decided that this is a better education. And education, as I'm sure Representative Roland will tell you, is if they think it's better, it is better. And all we're doing is saying that now the receiving school will get some remuneration for that. They've taken on the responsibility. Now let's give them at least some of the money.
Rep Butler, I just wondered if it was necessary to clarify for the record that Harper is also a boarding school for special needs kids, which meets only 4 days a week, and that is the specific area in focus here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that specifically is part of the issue, and it is how the needs of this particular special needs students is presently being addressed. And so I'm anxious that if you need to have this delineated, I think the bill itself talks about the underlying direct cost of the student relating to the basic funding, particularly once the 11% has been exceeded for the handicapped. But my issue is that if it needs to be further addressed to identify this within counties of less than 50,000 population, I think that's a very easy fix so far as a -2 amendment, so that we can continue to move forward. We're not just talking about unhappy superintendents here. We're talking about the lives of some very important youngsters, the next generation of Oregonians. And my concern is that to the extent that the Oregon Department of Education is anxious about choice in education, particularly when we're talking about the students' needs being better met, I'm very anxious about anyone who is opposed to that kind of competition in education, because I believe that brings out the excellence in part of it.
Thank you, Representative Butler. If you would be so accommodating, I think that we need to probably do a little bit more narrowing and get that down to a -2 amendment so that we can resolve some of the wider-ranging impacts that would perhaps come forward. So we will await that arrival before we move on to the
Thank
next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there is precedence in statute at this time that talks about counties under 35 and counties under 50,000 having some additional latitude in this regard, and I would and this perhaps would address Representative March's concern that perhaps Eastern Oregon would dump some high-need students on Multnomah County. We have absolutely no desire to do that. We have a desire to keep these youngsters in the best environment where the schools will better meet their needs. Remember again, the folks that we're dealing with and the administrators are many times administrators who have returned to these districts after retirement in other states, have returned home, in effect, to address specific needs in the communities, and have been very successful. The success of these kinds of folks is very, very heartwarming, and I appreciate your desire to continue to hear this, Madam Chair, and we'll bring forward with your committee administrator the required amendments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will look forward to that so that we can get this on the road. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2070. Yes. We will move to a public hearing on House Bill 3151. Mr. Keller?
House Bill 3151 requires school districts with a certain number of students and specified percentage of students who qualify for federal school lunch programs during prior school year to provide lunches to eligible students, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. We have a dash one amendment, a dash two, I'm sorry. And the dash two would allow a waiver for school districts who can demonstrate they are meeting the requirements through an alternative program. Delays in the implementation until July 1st, 2007. I've also attached the recent fiscal received today. I also have it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I have a signed letter from the chair, Representative Flores, and Speaker Karen Menes, allowing us to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Barr, would you like to give us the benefit of your wisdom?
Thank you. Let me just speak briefly. I know that you're getting tired of hearing from me on this issue.
Never.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I bring to you House Bill 3151 with dash two amendments. I'm going to make my comments brief, but I wanted to give you just a little bit of background on the program. House Bill 3151 requires school districts of 125 or more students that have at least 20% of those students who qualify for free or reduced lunch to participate in the USDA school lunch program. The districts affected by the bill are Pleasant Hill, 1,029 students, Lowell, 271 students, ALSEI, 166 students, and Power School District. The most recent numbers are 149. The bill will take effect July 07 in order to give school districts time to plan and implement the program. And this is very important. If a school district can demonstrate that they are meeting the nutritional requirements of hungry kids, then they can receive a waiver exempting them from participating in the federal program. Many school districts have kitchen facilities that are no longer functional or don't have kitchen facilities at all. But this is an obstacle that can be overcome and has been overcome by other school districts in Oregon by contracting out the service to another school district, restaurant, or assisted living center. These are just some examples of ways that school districts can still participate in the program. The USDA program doesn't require the meal to be hot, just to have the nutritional components of protein, bread, vegetables, fruit, and milk, and you probably will all remember my visual aid where I demonstrated what a school lunch can consist of. The National School Lunch Program began in 1947 as a measure of national security to safeguard the health and well-being of the nation's children and to encourage the domestic consumption of nutritious agricultural commodities and other food. The program is administered by the Oregon Department of Education through an agreement with the United States Department of Education. Through an agreement with the United States Department of Agriculture, Food, and Nutrition Services. I should proofread my letters before I read them to you. The USDA reimburses $2.25 for children who qualify for free, $1.86 for those qualifying for reduced price lunches, and 23 cents for kids who pay full price. The state then provides an additional 5-cent reimbursement per meal. Schools make up the difference in reimbursement by charging a price to the students that can afford to pay that covers their costs. cost. With data from the Department of Education, I compiled the enrollment requirement, which should allow for the school districts not currently offering the program to break even on their expenditure. And I might also say that the Bethel School District in Eugene has been able to do that consistently. And so I think that that's an example of a school district that, in working with the Department of Ed, and the Department of Ed stands poised, ready to help all of the districts in question. My motivation is to be sure that every child has an access to a good education, and House Bill 3151 is legislation that moves towards accomplishing it, because as all of us know, we can't teach hungry kids. When kids are hungry, statistically, you know, and I can provide lots of data to any of you that want it, kids are unable to learn. Lowell, for example, who's one of the school districts that is affected by this bill, has already taken steps to comply with the USDA requirements. And they found that simply by offering toast and juice to their kids in the morning, to their hungry kids, they've had a dramatic decrease in acting out in the playground. They've had a huge increase in attention in the classroom. So I think these are some this is a very simple example. And remember, toast and juice, that doesn't stay with you a real long time. That doesn't include protein. So I think that we can see that with the addition of protein, vegetables, fruit, and milk, and bread, we're going to give kids a good, healthy way to pay attention in class and to really accomplish something great. So with that, I know that we have one other testimony.
Whoa.
Oh, there's some questions.
Questions. Ooh. Okay.
There are questions for Representative Farr. Representative Dolan.
Representative Farr, you had four schools. Lowell, Powers. What were the other two?
Pleasant Hill, 1,029 students. Lowell, 271 students, Alsea, 166, and Powers School District. And this is a disputed amount. I'm using 149, which was the original amount. Data from the Department of Ed said they thought that they fell below the 125 enrollment requirement. But in discussing this with Representative Roblin, since he knows the superintendent there, the superintendent believes that they do meet the enrollment requirement.
With just four schools involved, why are we summoning all the weight of the legislature to force compliance by four schools?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can sum that up very easily, because we've got kids that are hungry, high percentages of kids. You know, in a perfect world, every parent has the means and capabilities to provide food for their children, but in the real world, some kids go to school hungry because there isn't any food at home.
Have those local school boards addressed this issue?
Lowell has, because they're already in the process of participating in the lunch program. And I know that Heidi Dupuy is here from the Oregon Department of Ed Nutritional Program, so she may be able to answer some additional questions that you have regarding these other school districts. Pleasant Hill and their superintendent is here today, and he and I met in my office. They do have a lunch program that offers lunch to some students, but it's not feeding all of the hungry kids. It's not able to meet all of the need. But it is, they're doing a great job of addressing some of the need, and that's why the amendment allows them, if they want to continue and expand their program and do it just with volunteer efforts. But remember, the federal government is providing a reimbursement. So why anyone who's offering a lunch program wouldn't want to receive that reimbursement from the federal government and the state? You know, it just makes common sense to do that. Oh. Otherwise, you can't break even. It's an expenditure that has no reimbursement.
But what is the bill requiring schools to participate in a lunch program?
Unless they can demonstrate they're doing it another way, they don't have to participate.
My question again, perhaps I'll wait for the superintendents, but haven't these school districts addressed this issue?
No.
Why? Do you know why?
I can only speak for Pleasant Hill because Steve and I have met. Their kitchen facilities are outdated and no longer. Is that correct, Steve? Steve, would you like to come up? Is it all right if I invite Steve Waddell, superintendent from Pleasant Hill School District, to join me?
Of course, please. We welcome you forward, and for the record, we'll have you recite your name into the place.
I'm Steve Waddell, superintendent of the Pleasant Hill School District.
So,
Steve, what does this legislation do for you that your local board can't or won't do for you?
Well, historically, if I may, Madam Chair, the community decided not to, this is my first year in Pleasant Hill, and the community had decided not to offer a free and reduced or a full lunch program for any students. That was a community decision. Along the way, they recognized that there were hungry children coming into the school, so they developed a volunteer program to feed the kids. When this bill came along, it was quite a surprise, and so I went back and checked. I'd already been talked to by one of my PTA presidents regarding some of the hungry kids, and they identified 31 of them at our elementary school. And so I went through and talked to the principals, and they had a volunteer program in which they were feeding the kids. So I made sure first that hungry kids were indeed getting fed. The issue for our school district is twofold. One is, are hungry kids getting fed? Two, do you have to do that through a federally regulated program? There are costs over and above what the reimbursements will be, because we have not invested yet in any program. So if we were to purchase a kitchen, which that could cost us from $250,000 to $500,000, that would be just for one. We have three schools. And then we'd have to figure a way on how to transport the meals out, which would require other equipment. So generally speaking, there is investment costs, then there are going to be operational costs, which the reimbursement will begin to take care of once you've put this into place. And then there are compliance costs. And I'm not sure our compliance costs will always be covered by the reimbursements. Now, Representative Farr has done a wonderful job in backing up from the bill and allowing us time to look at what the costs were. Because in talking to the four superintendents, none of us had been contacted for any type of investigative information. So she now has a waiver in there that is very helpful to us as well. If we can show that through our volunteer efforts or through a different manner, the district is feeding the kids.
And I think that your original question was, why don't they have kitchen facilities? And I think that some of them are outdated, and the new school doesn't have a kitchen.
They've never had any kitchens in the community. As I understand it, through the history, there's been three or four times that the community's come to vote on a bond and they decided not to have a kitchen.
And you are addressing this locally now?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is, I agree with hungry kids. We shouldn't have any. Why 125? You mentioned it the time before, but there's do you know how many school districts there are that are not in this, that are not providing lunches?
I think there are only two other school districts that fall below the requirement for enrollment, and one of them is Jordan Valley, and it's a boarding school. It's very remote, so, and Heidi can speak to this, but I assume that they're already addressing it, yeah, because it's a boarding school. And then there is a school district, Lake Side, I think, in Portland. They fall below the enrollment requirements. And then there's another school, very small, but that particular school district is also very wealthy. I mean, extremely wealthy. So they wouldn't meet the 20%. Even if they met the enrollment requirement, there wouldn't be 20% that qualified. There wouldn't be any that qualified. The other school district, we actually had a presentation from them here. They're in Representative Butler's district. And I think if you remember, I asked that question, and they actually had written a grant. And so through funding with this grant and then community volunteer support, and their school district, I think, is 65 students, they've been able to provide food.
Further questions? We're satisfied? Thank you both very much.
I think that what's important to say, that just a comment that I want to make, is that, I never intended to impugn the reputation of Pleasant Hill. I'm impressed with what they do. They've done an admirable job, but they're not meeting the needs of all the hungry kids. They don't offer the lunch program at every one of their schools. So that's, there's the rub.
Thank you.
That's the problem. The assimilation of some other kids in the community that are quite low income, another school district that they assimilated, and that kind of changed the student makeup as well. So my motivation is simply to be sure that kids are fed, and that's why I introduced the bill.
Thank you, Representative Farr. David Williams, and perhaps along with him, I would like to call Cindy Hunt.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Just wanted to put on the record, we had some concerns with the initial bill, but as was mentioned, very pleased Representative Farr worked with us and Chuck Bennett from the Confederation of School Administrators, and as well as Steve Waddell, Superintendent of Pleasant Hill, to try to alleviate many of those concerns with the waiver from the department, as well as the two-year timeline to give those districts who are not in compliant time to properly assess the costs and the ways to implement the bill. So as the Dash 2 amendments stand, we think that we agree with those.
Thank you. Ms. Hunt? I wanted to make sure that we had everything clear and precise in regard to the requirement discussion, and wanted to be able to address it early as opposed to later. And so with the criteria of 125 students in the district and 20% or more of the district students were eligible for free and reduced lunch, does that pretty much tighten the circle around any requirement in today's parlance mandate for other school districts?
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Madam Chair, the original bill as written does require, if you are a school district that has 125 or more of students and the 20% or more that are eligible for free and reduced lunches, it does require them then to provide lunches to the students. Of course, the Dash 2 amendments changed that a bit. But the original bill, as written, is a requirement on those school districts that meet those initial requirements in the bill.
Is it your understanding, then, that that pretty well narrows the field to the small number that Representative Farr had addressed?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure exactly how many school districts that meet these requirements aren't currently providing school lunches. So I don't know how many more school districts this would place additional requirements on.
Representative Farr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Heidi Dupuy did not sign up to testify, but she's here, and I think she can provide that information for us.
Thanks, Heidi.
For the record, I'm Heidi Dupuy with the Department of Education Child Nutrition Programs. And every year, enrollment changes and the demographics of our school districts change. But for the data that we currently have for the from the fall of October of 2004, that there are is this group of, just as Representative Farr described, of four. Powers, which is the one in question, our current enrollment data for them puts them at 65 students. Previously, they would have been above the, and last year they were above the 120 enrollment, and they would meet the percentage of free and reduced. And then Lowell, Pleasant Hill, and Alsey are above, and those are the only ones that are currently not offering the National School Lunch Program that have enrollment above 125 and 20% free and reduced by enrollment.
Do you have any notion why they don't, why they've chosen not to?
With the exception of ALSI, Pleasant Hill, Lowell, and Powers do participate in this special milk program. So there is an awareness that there is a need for nutrition during the day, and how they've done that is through providing unlimited milk. Essentially, USDA has no limit on the number of milks a child can consume under the special milk program. And for all actually all four of those, it is really a plant problem. They do not have kitchen facilities. They're either outdated and could not pass a food safety inspection, or they don't exist at all. And so the ability to provide meals is limited. Alcee and Powers are both in remote areas of the coastal range, and so they have difficulty getting food products into their communities, which would add to their cost.
Do you know if their local school boards have wrestled with this problem?
I have. Well, I know that Lowell's had, because they're currently actively preparing to participate in the National School Lunch Program. Alcee's has in the past. We have been active with them over the past 7 or 10 years, providing technical assistance to them, and it's always been providing the finances to upgrade their facilities to be able to have a program that's been their stumbling block. So they have addressed it, and they have sought assistance in that. And I do not know about Powers.
Could they participate in this program right now without this legislation?
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Representative Clark.
Heidi, would the Department of Ed be able to work with the school districts to help them find a way, if they can't update their kitchens or build kitchens, to contract the service out, to find someone that could provide the lunches so they can bring them in?
Madam Chair and Representative Farr, yes, we do provide that service to be able to track down and find ways that they could get it done. Whether we would be 100% successful in doing that, because if you're going to contract out, once you move out, then you need two parties to be agreeable, and it doesn't always happen. But we would work to explore and exhaust all the possibilities for those districts.
I have a follow-up. I know that in Powers, because it's a remote community, it may be difficult to bring lunches in. If would you be able to work with that school district to find a way, maybe just to identify the kids that are hungry, and if they can't participate in the USDA program, maybe help them find a way to address the nutritional needs of just that population?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we could do that.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
We have as a follow-up, we have in other school districts to assist with the purchasing, at least gotten the conversation started between some of their commercial providers. I mean, people who are receiving commercial products, like a local grocery store or convenience store that's in the same community, to combine their purchasing so that they can take advantage of that purchasing power, and looking at caterers and just what's available in the community to make it happen.
I have another follow-up. In regards to Representative Dahlem's question about local school boards and local school districts addressing the problem, do you think that the superintendent of everyone, and I know this probably is for Steve too, but do you think that they know every child in their school district who may come from a food insecure household? Would they be able to identify on site those children?
Madam Chair and Representative Farr, families that are food insecure work very hard to make themselves look like the rest of the population. They do not want to stand out. And superintendents are pretty far removed from the individual students, in my opinion. But the people who do know are probably their teachers, because they work with them every day, and through both being with the students in the classroom as well as to teacher conferences, can have other indicators that their households are food insecure.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Would students who participate in the free milk program, would they generally meet the income guidelines to qualify for free or reduced lunch?
Madam Chair and Representative Farr, yes, the guidelines are the same for qualifying for free milk as for free meals. And all of those districts do participate in the free milk program, so they are taking applications and are familiar with that administrative work.
Ms. DeFlea, did you provide the information to Legislative Fiscal for the fiscal impact statement?
I did.
Okay. I just have one question, okay. And that is, you indicate the fiscal effect on local education agencies cannot be determined at this time. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Representative Flores, Madam Chair, we have in... at our last review of the financial statements from school districts, about half are in the black and half are in the red.
We've talked about that.
We have talked about that, and that's why it's undetermined. I have some, I don't have that right on the top of my tongue, but the two most recent additions to the National School Lunch Program were Gaston School District and St. Paul School District, and if my recollections, both of those are either in the black or very close to being in the black. They're about the same size of school districts as we're talking about adding here, but all of those, what determines whether a school district is going to be financially successful depends on community support, purchasing acumen, ability to plan and do it, and that's undeterminable at our level. We are working on, but have not yet put together what a perfect funding package, what a perfect management package for a school program would be to set as a benchmark or standard.
And we'll be having follow-up conversations. Okay. Thank you. Additional questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3151, and we will open a work session on House Bill 3151. And move to consider the Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3151.
Representative Fallon moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3151. Is there discussion? Objection? If no objection, then so moved.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3151. We have a Dash 1 amendment too, don't we?
Dash 2, I'm sorry. It's as amended.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3151 to the floor as the due pass amendment and recommend with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means to be rescinded.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 3151 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion, House Bill 3151 should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded, will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Representative
Barr?
Aye.
Representative
Dunn?
Representative
Roman?
Aye.
Representative
Shields?
Aye.
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 Aye. Chair Flores? Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared passed. We will close the work session on health. Oops, we'll have a carrier. How about Representative Farr?
Good idea.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3151. Thank you. We will move to a public hearing on House Bill 3165. Mr. Keller, please.
House Bill 3165 specifies that reports of the Quality Education Commission, Legislative Assembly, and Governor on sufficiency of monies to meet quality goals for state system of kindergarten through grade 12 public education are based on requirements and quality goals of federal law and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005.
Thank you. Brian Reeder and Lori Wimmer Whalen.
Thank you.
My apologies. I thought the vices were going to... You may proceed. In whatever order you would choose. Mr. Reeder, you're ready and poised.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Brian Reeder. I'm with the Policy Research and Analysis section at the Department of Education. I also serve as staff to the Quality Education Commission. Just wanted to state briefly today that the department and the commission, neither of those bodies has taken a position on this bill, but I would like to make some further comments, and you may gather from those that we have a bit of anxiety about this bill. My understanding is that the bill would require the Quality Education Commission to make estimates of the cost of meeting the requirements of the No Child Left Behind legislation. And as you know, that federal legislation requires that all students in every state in the union meet that each state's, or that, excuse me, particular state in which they live, meet the requirements. And that is a very high bar to set for a nation, for its schools, that every child meet the educational goals of the state in which they live. Currently in Oregon, in our elementary schools, we are in the ballpark in the high 70s, low 80% in some schools, in the high 80s and low 90% of students meeting standards. But as you get into middle and high schools, we are on the order of in the mid-40s to low 50% of students meeting standards. The Commission and the Department of Education would love to know how much it would cost to meet the federal standards, but the reality is we don't know, and I don't believe that it is possible to make credible estimates of how much it would cost to meet the federal requirements. As you know, the Commission, as a practice, since its inception, has made estimates of how much it would cost to get 90% of Oregon students to standard, and currently those estimates are on the order of $2 billion more than the legislature is currently talking about appropriating for schools for the 05-07 biennium. The reason I do not believe we can make credible estimates for meeting the requirements of No Child Left Behind is because no state has ever gotten even close to those requirements. It's what forecasters call trying to forecast out of range. It's trying to estimate things that we have no experience with, and that means there's a great deal of uncertainty about your estimates. Now, having said that, we can make such estimates, but we will have virtually no confidence in them. So, I really do believe it's not a valuable exercise, what this bill is proposing.
Ms. Whalen?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the 43,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. I'm also a member of the Quality Education Model Cost Panel for the last interim, so we have some experience working with these statutes that this bill would seek to amend. And we, too, have some concerns. You have my written testimony. By the way, I will be using the terms QEM for Quality Education Model, OEA for Oregon Education Association, NCLB for No Child Left Behind, and all the other alphabets.
You got it.
Our concern is that back in the year 2000, the citizens of Oregon passed a constitutional amendment, ballot measure one it was, that asked that the state calculate and fund the cost of educating a student according to our state standards, or under law. And the conversation, and I gave you even a copy of some of our voters' pamphlet statement, and as well as the measure itself with my testimony, that showed that the citizens of Oregon felt that they were voting on, and they did so overwhelmingly, a measure to reflect Oregon's law, the Oregon Educational Act for the 21st century. And I think it makes some sense to add to that calculus other cost drivers, such as the federal No Child Left Behind law. We don't quarrel with adding that, and as a matter of fact, the cost panel has struggled with that, as Mr. Reeder explained to you, with some trepidation, but we know that there needs to be some way of saying yes, and then this will cost that much more. And we don't quarrel with the idea of adding that to the law. We do quarrel with replacing it as the cost driving, as the thing that the quality education model would measure. And we do that because it's counterintuitive. Let me give you an example. House Bill 3165 would ask that the quality education mandate or quality education model delete the statutes that I've listed for you in my testimony. A really key one to me is the educational goals found in Oregon law. And again, I've attached that to my testimony for you to see. The Legislative Assembly believes that education is a major civilizing influence on the development of a humane, responsible, and informed citizenry. It starts there. Students must be encouraged to learn of their heritage, their place in the global society. Furthermore, it talks about the goals of kindergarten through grade 12 to demand academic excellence through a rigorous academic program that equips students with information and skills necessary to pursue the future of their choice, to provide an environment that motivates students to pursue serious scholarship and to have experience applying knowledge and skills and demonstrating achievement, and to provide students with lifelong academic skills that will prepare them for an ever-changing world. I think those are pretty key. Furthermore, the other pieces are that our educational standards are a lot more expansive than NCLB. For example, we have math, science, English, history, geography, economics, civics, physical education, health, the arts, and second languages, all of which would be deleted in the cost calculus, whereas NCLB is just English, math, and science. And we think that what you measure is what you teach. And given that Oregon standards are, I would argue, more ambitious and more thorough, we wouldn't want to fail to capture that when we try to determine what it costs to educate a student in Oregon. And finally, I would say that the quality education model is itself, I believe, vastly misunderstood, because everyone knows what the 90% number is and gets sticker shock. The fact is, it is simply a tool for the legislature to use to determine what it would cost to bring any particular percentage of students to those student outcomes, the achievement standards. And you could take a different aim. You could take the 99 or now 97% standard of NCLB. You could take an 80% standard, and you will get a different number for each of those. It is simply a way to do the cost analysis to bring students to a particular academic outcome, and it isn't a particular number. And so I would argue that, if anything, we need more information, not less. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. excuse me, Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, I'm wondering if perhaps there was a misspeak or I misunderstood, because when you were using reference to the ORSs that would be touched by this bill, you indicated that these concerns would be deleted, these specific ORSs, and as I'm not seeing a reference to deleting but more amending language.
Madam Chair, on line 5 of page 1 of the bill, everything in italics is deleted, and line 6 references those statutes that I reference. And italics is deletion, of course.
I see where you picked that up. Thank you. Representative Roblin.
And I'll ask you, because it sounds like your testimony agrees with the way I was seeing this bill, and so I just want to make sure that I have this right. The way I'm reading this is that we have relinquished all control over the standards of Oregon to the federal government.
Madam Chair and Representative Roblin, at least for the purpose of calculating the cost,
right.
Unless we're going to repeal the statute outright, we would still have the statute in law. We would just ignore it for the purposes of costing the education.
Representative March.
Thank you. Mr. Reeder, does the No Child Left Behind Act cover all Oregon schools?
Representative Flores, Representative March, I believe it covers all public schools in Oregon. It requires that students in all public schools meet Oregon standards by 2014, as well as setting some interim goals on its way to achieving that.
But not just the Title I schools.
Well, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Flores?
I believe it is just the Title I schools, isn't it?
No.
Just Just one involved.
Chair Flores, Representative Gollum, certain sanctions apply only to Title I schools, but the law applies to all schools.
Representative Roblin.
For clarification, the sanctions apply currently to Title I schools. Over time, they apply to all schools. Mm-hmm. By 2014, they're fully implemented to all schools, is my belief. I have that right. But currently, it does not.
Madam Chair.
A statement or a question?
No, it's mostly a comment. I was just trying to help.
Madam Chair, I would echo that. I know, for example, the educational support professionals have to have the associate's degree in Title I schools, for example, now, but not in other schools. But, so there are different sanctions.
So as I'm understanding the thrust of both of your testimonies is that you feel that it is, if I'm surmising, virtually impossible for the QEM to overlay and reflect and evaluate the impact of No Child Left Behind or incorporate that within the quality education model.
Madam Chair, my testimony was that we wouldn't object to adding it to it, but not replacing the state's Educational Act for the 21st century. In other words, if they were both part of the calculus, we would have no objection.
Chair Flores, I would agree with your statement. It is my belief as a person who forecasts things that trying to forecast how much it would cost to get 99 or 97% of Oregon students to meet current Oregon standards is an exercise fraught with uncertainty. And the quality education model and the process that we use could give you a number, but in that process I would have to tell you that this number is within 100% of the true number. In other words, I don't have a clue whether it's right or not. I can tell you, though, I think it would be a very large number. The quality ed model currently says that the state school fund in 05-07 ought to be $7.1 billion, which is about $2 billion above where I think this appropriation coming out of this legislature will end up. I would argue that to meet the requirements of NCLB, that number would be on the order of $10 or $12 billion. But I would also tell you at the same time that I think that there's so much uncertainty with that number that you probably shouldn't use it for anything. It would be like trying to forecast state revenue 25 years from now. You just can't do it with any degree of confidence. You have tools that will allow you to get to a number, but you won't have any confidence in that number.
That being a given, and when you're using the example that it could, incorporating No Child Left Behind into the considerations of the quality education model, could be $12 billion. Are you talking including capital construction costs, which currently are not included in that hydraulic?
Chair Flores, no. We would be on the same basis that we currently do, operating costs only.
Okay. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you gave us the rundown on how the model worked, the difference you're seeing is not so much in the things that we're dropping out of No Child Left Behind. It's in that raising that last 10% of kids who are our most at-risk kids and the kids that have the most difficult time with learning. Raising them, that each one of those percentiles costs a lot more money, whether it's math, science, and English, or whatever the subject is, to get there. And that's the part you're having a hard time identifying.
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, that's exactly correct. As anyone who has worked in schools knows, there are all sorts of different students with all sorts of different capabilities and circumstances, and some students simply have different, they face much different challenges and have much more difficulty in meeting certain academic requirements than other students do. Now, there is evidence that adding resources can help bring those students along, and for a lot of them, getting to the current standards is a possibility, but it may be very expensive. For some of those students, getting them to the state standards may simply not be possible under any circumstances. and that is something that I believe the federal No Child Left Behind legislation has failed to recognize until recently, when it has made some concessions. But the notion that every student can meet standard is a notion that a lot of people would not embrace, and a lot of people do not think is possible.
Are you satisfied, Mr. Representative Roland?
Yes, so far.
Oh.
Okay.
I wanted to just kind of give you, for purposes of why we're even talking about this, some of the information from the interim report, which I think that probably you both reviewed, wherein the quality education model was discussed, and a couple of issues that were raised by the interim committee. Number one, the need for clarification of the cost elements within the QEM. And number two, could the emphasis of the QEM be placed on elements that could likely be changed rather than costs of the full implementation? Now, when you're considering adding the No Child Left Behind considerations, Mr. Reeder, into your $12 billion highly speculative figure, does that consider components of the current system that could be changed, considerations, the QEM considerations that could be changed, as opposed to leaving everything just the way it is and then throwing in NCLB on top of it?
Chair Flores, first of all, the $12 billion is something I pulled out of the air in the last few minutes.
So
you are correct when you say it's highly speculative.
Yeah. But that's why I said it.
I just want to clarify that what the Quality Education Commission tries to do with the model is to bring in the best research available on practices that are most effective in helping kids learn. So when you say, could we do things, bring things in that we hadn't brought in before, or stop doing certain things in the current model, I'm not quite sure where that leads, whether we're using the current assumption of 90% of students meeting standard, or switching that to 97 or 99 or 100%. I don't believe that that means we entirely throw out the model and use a whole different approach to education in Oregon. I don't think that a change in that assumption necessarily means that we would choose different methods as the best practices. So I guess maybe I'm not entirely sure what you're asking. Are you asking, do we need a different kind of model if we're going to use NCLB as our goal, as opposed to some other goal?
And probably it was not addressed clearly, but I guess what I'm trying to get to is the possibility of redundancies in what we may be doing as what might be required by No Child Left Behind, what we might be doing as the state of Oregon within our whole practicum, and what is required by No Child Left Behind.
Well, Chair Flores, let me just, what I would say is that No Child Left Behind does not require practice, certain kinds of practices. It simply says
standards.
You will get to standard. That's what it does. And so in terms, are we doing different things than No Child Left Behind asks us to do? The answer is no, because it doesn't ask us to do anything in terms of practices. It simply asks us to get students to meet standards.
And once again, standards that we establish as the State of Oregon Department of Education and have been approved by the federal government. Is that correct?
Chair Flores, those standards were established by the legislature, not by the Department of Education.
Oh, sorry, right. I correct myself.
But that is correct. The standards that No Child Left Behind holds states to are state standards. It simply says you must get all of your students to meet those state standards.
I think that the standards were established by a rather large committee involving educators and stakeholders in the process, wasn't it? The state was asked, the legislature asked that standards be set. And then I believe that teachers had a hand in setting the standards, didn't they? I've asked that before, and I don't want to give you a trick question, but I did ask that before, and I believe we were told that everybody was in, that the stakeholders were involved in setting standards.
Did you want to answer that, Representative?
I can help with that.
Okay.
Thank you. I think the initial 21st Century Act came from the legislature and had standards embedded in it. And then the standard by title, and then the embellishment of what those standards, how to meet those standards, was developed through conversations, and teachers and all those other people came together to talk about how do we meet those standards and what fleshed the standards out. But the initial standards, the legislature and a few people, and actually, if you were to ask me, I would say that they came from the East Coast of the United States. There was a conference that happened, and there were some people there, and some of those people came back here. But
I suspected that, Representative Roblin, but I asked about it several times. How were those standards set? And you heard that, and yeah, we were told that we did set them here in the States. And I would ask, how many people are we asking with the Oregon Education Act? How many students are we asking to get over the bar at the high school level in order to meet the standard? The No Child Left Behind is asking for 100%. What are we asking in the state?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlin, I'm not sure we...
What is our expectation as a state?
Well, I'm not sure we have an officially stated expectation as a state. The Quality Education Commission has, in trying to make an estimate of what it would cost to run an effective education system, has assumed that 90% of students meeting standards is a good goal, perhaps an interim goal on our way to something better than that. But I am not aware of an officially stated goal by the legislature or the Department of Education or anyone else. We try to get as many kids to meet standard as is possible. But in terms of saying we want 70% or 80% or 90%, I don't believe we have done that officially as a state.
Madam Chair, can I add something?
Please.
ORS 329.065, which is one of the ones that would be deleted according to this bill, is the provision that says that none of the standards of the 21st Act, the Educational Act of the 21st Century, will be mandated if the funds aren't there to pay for it. It's the no unfunded mandate section of that act. And so I think implicit in that is the assumption that if the legislature is unable to provide the resources to get all students to standard, that the number of students who are to meet the standard is those the dollars will buy.
Representative Roblin?
Two questions, two parts.
Okay, A and B.
A slight answer to that one, in that the model was developed as a continuous improvement model with the understanding that every year we'd get better, and there wasn't a high end at the top. It was money and how we get there. But the other question that I think goes more to what Chair Flores was talking about has to do with, if we take this model, QEM, and we say, you know, the mathematical model, and we say we want it to be based on No Child Left Behind, and we're going to fund that, then kind of what we heard from Ms. Wehmer-Williams was that you drop, if we don't have to do any PE, and we don't have to do any art, and we don't have to do any geography, and we don't have to do any social studies, because the only things being tested are math, English, and science, then the allocation of resources could go to just math, English, and science. Therefore, when you produce the model, you could put those resources that are currently being spent on those other things all into those three things, and you may come up with a different number. Is that possible?
Chair Flores, Representative Roland, I think you certainly could do that. If you assume that we are no longer going to do anything that is not part of the way you meet NCLB, then it changes the calculations dramatically. It means we don't provide school lunches or PE or all those other things. Now I think you make an argument from educators about PE helping kids learn math because they feel better, or it's hard to put different subject areas in little boxes in an education setting and say we're going to learn this one but we don't care about that one. But I would agree with you, it changes the calculus tremendously.
Part B.
Along that same line, it doesn't mean that we've taken the statutes away that say the schools have to provide it. this would just say that all we're going to tell you what it costs to fund are those things. See, the state would still have to provide the other things because they're still part of the state statute. But the answer we get from QEM would be just that part of it that meets no child left behind, as I read this.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I think that because of the statute I just cited, you wouldn't necessarily have to offer them.
Additional question? You're chewing on one, I can tell.
Representative March. And I think Representative Roblin sort of getting to the kernel of it, and that is if we teach to the tests of No Child Left Behind, in essence, that's what we're talking about. And assume we do away with those other things. Probably the number one driver is class size at that point. And so, you know, you may save in not offering PE, civics, et cetera, but you, and of course then we'd have to go in and reapply because we've come up with this new state standard that only tests to the federal standards. But assuming we did that, to get to 100%, you're going to have to cut your class sizes down to 12 or less in some instances. I mean, I don't think there's any savings here. Am I wrong in that?
Vice Chair March, I guess I would go back to my earlier comments, and that is we just don't know. If we said we cared only about those subject areas that NCLB required, then a rational school district would reduce their class sizes and work very hard in those subject areas, and you know, even if they had to continue to offer those other subject areas, would obviously put less effort into them. And we may see non-essential classes with class sizes of 50 and 60 in order to afford much smaller class sizes in English, math, and science. That's an obvious approach if your only goal is to meet NCLB requirements as opposed to provide a well-rounded education for kids.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I have a question regarding 329.025 under Characteristics of School System. Number one provides equal and open access and educational opportunities for all students in the state. That concerns me tremendously, specifically because of my district, which would have a high level of poverty, a high level of English as a second language learners, and a high level of special ed students. Am I reading that correctly, that would not be a requirement then any longer, that the state would provide for those needs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Farr, it was my testimony that we would no longer use any of those statutes to determine the cost of educating Oregon public school students. But unless you outright repealed the statute, it would still be on the books. It would just not be funded.
Follow up? But obviously the cost is pretty significant in implementing these particular programs.
Madam Chair and Representative Farr, that's our belief as well.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3165. And it looks like that's it for today. Thank you very much. We will. You have time to kill.
And no Friday.
And it's not even Friday.
And we don't have Friday.
And we do not have Friday. We will be in school in district
Friday. I just wanted to make sure that got mentioned because it's going to be fun. I got four schools in four cities.
Great.
I only have three schools, but I'm having a town hall that night.
That's good.
47 schools.
He's going to 47 schools. That's good big. Job. 47 schools. We stand adjourned.
Down. John Day.
How are you doing?